Iran warns that the US is seeking to create rifts between Afghanistan and its neighboring countries. Yemen says the Saudi-led coalition's footage purportedly showing weapons at Hodeidah and Salif ports has been taken from a documentary about Iraq. And the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of occupied Al-Quds says extremist Israeli groups are threatening the presence of Christians in the Holy City. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister criticizes the U.S. and its allies for what he calls their wrong policies in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking with Afghanistan's acting foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi, in Tehran. Amir Abdullahian said, "History has shown that no foreign power can occupy and rule Afghanistan." The Iranian top diplomat warned that the U.S. is seeking to create rifts between Afghanistan and its neighboring countries. He also called for the release of the Afghan central bank assets that remain frozen by the U.S. The Afghan official said Iran has always stood by his country. Amir Khan Muttaqi said the U.S. left Afghanistan with a disgraceful defeat and still continues its policies against people there. Firas Nejim is the manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights and joins us now from Ottawa. Firas, welcome. United States wasted billions, or I should say trillions to be more precise, of dollars in Afghanistan. Didn't achieve its goals. Will it try and, just leave the country in peace and stability and prosperity with its neighbors?
I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. used Afghanistan as a landscape to practice all their weapons and train there and, destroy the nation and keep it in the worst conditions. This was the motive from the American side, is that they, fabricated a justification to invade that country. And this was an area for them to just try all their new weapons and, train their army to get stronger. And it was the door to open in the Middle East to expand their invasions and to try to install fear in other countries and continue on the path of occupying and colonizing. And they failed miserably. And we've seen that after 20 years, as the foreign minister of Iran said. And they have always tried to cause sectarian problems between the Muslim Sunnis and the Muslim Shias. Now that they know that Iran is primarily a Shia government, with Sunni obviously precincts inside, and they know now that Afghanistan is a Sunni, primarily a Sunni government as well. So they want, and they know that there's a borderline between them and there's neighbors, and they're trying to cause sectarian problems between Sunnis and Shias. This is what they're hoping for. To keep Iran busy and weaker, while they go and expand their, their ventures and all their criminal activities in different countries, and we've seen that this is not going to happen. The Afghanis at this point right now know that their only true partner that could help them and assist them if they were under severe sanctions or a blockade or bombardment, let's just say,
right,
that Iran will support. And Iran has been supporting gradually all the time. We see a lot of aid being sent over from Iran to Afghanistan. Iran also cares about its neighbor, and they want to strengthen Afghanistan, because the strengthening of a neighboring country will strengthen your own country as well, right? Because security matters, trading, all kinds of things. So
right.
You can see that America has obviously propped up Daesh. There was two suicide bombings that happened in Afghanistan where they killed Shia worshippers, and this was the beginning of the U.S. Work. This is their work. This is their work. They did this in Iraq. We've seen they did this in Syria. They're trying to do this in Lebanon as well many times. So we're hoping that this obviously will fail, and that the Afghani government will take the lead to fight terrorism and fight any extremism, so they can build a better bond and relationship with their neighboring country, Iran, that obviously cares about the interest of the neighborhood and
right.
The whole region.
Well, yes. You know, for us, we've heard from experts that creating hunger, starvation, poverty among millions of people, you know, that will only lead to violence, which can spill over. How important is it for Washington to release Afghanistan's assets, which have been frozen by the United States, which belong to the Afghan people?
The U.S. obviously is not, most likely is not going to release these funds, because like you said, that they want the poverty, they want the problems, they want people to be suffering and hungry, so there can be more disunity and there can be more instability in Afghanistan. And then they will hope that this will somehow create chaos and spill over to Iran somehow, or the other countries that are around. So, you know, the only way that Iran was able to get some of their assets back was when they took the American embassy and, you know, its diplomats hostage. Unfortunately, that they had to get to that situation where they have to do something like that to be able to get it back. The only way the U.S. for some reason works is by force and by aggression, because their nature is aggression and occupation and stuff like that. So the only way they negotiate is if there's another aggression that is against them, that has them in a tight spot and cornered, and then they kind of release something. Unfortunately, they don't care about human rights. They don't care about humanity. If they really did, they wouldn't be causing all these crises in Afghanistan, in Yemen, supporting the Saudi coalition, supporting the Israeli occupation of Palestine, blockading right now and causing a big embargo on Lebanon. You know, they've occupied Iraq for such a long time, and they left Iraq in the worst conditions. They won't even let the Iraqi government purchase fighter jets to safeguard their country and to claim and strengthen. Yeah, and sovereignty. And they even ended up killing the generals that fought ISIS, Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi. So we can see that the U.S. is not really working for human rights. They're not working for stability. They're not working for security. It's very clear. And we hope that the foreign minister of Iran and the foreign minister of Afghanistan can keep their collaboration and their cooperation and strengthen the borders and make sure that these two countries and these two nations build a stronger bond together and support each other. And I'm pretty sure Iran will continue to help.
For us, we have run out of time. Thank you very much indeed for your time and your thoughts. For us, Najim Deir, manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us live out of Ottawa. Meanwhile, a harsh winter has worsened the already dire conditions of millions of Afghans struggling with hunger and poverty, especially those who have become homeless or displaced due to droughts or conflicts over the past few months. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we are visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiri, a mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
I am a widow and have several children. I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather and severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist them for receiving some aids. Bushra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gulzad Group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S.
In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Elsewhere, Yemen says the Saudi-led coalition's pretexts for targeting the country's ports are mere theatrical posturing and aimed at legitimizing the aggression. The Yemeni foreign ministry says the remarks made by the coalition spokesperson, Turki al-Maliki, about militarizing Hodeidah and Salif ports are baseless and false. On Saturday, the coalition said targeting the two ports is justified, as Yemenis are using them as military bases. It's also released footage purportedly showing weapons stored at the ports, but the Yemeni army says the video is taken from an American documentary film about Iraq and has absolutely nothing to do with Yemen. The years-long Saudi-led war and blockade have put the lives of millions of Yemenis at risk and created what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Earlier, we reached out to political commentator Hossein Bukhaiti. He says the fake footage shown at the Saudi-led coalition's presser raises questions about its grounds for conducting thousands of airstrikes on Yemen.
This exactly shows what we here in Yemen, what Yemeni civilians are dealing with. They are dealing with the war that actually led by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is actually trying to fabricate news to attack Hodeidah port. I mean, it's really impossible as an example for Yemeni forces to use Hodeidah port, because there are a United Nations team located in Hodeidah, and as well all the ships are searched by the Saudi-backed forces and the Saudi coalition. But what Al-Asiri, actually he Al-Maliki, he did actually the biggest mistake. It shows that the war actually on Yemen based on lie. And just you can just imagine if Al-Maliki and the coalition is using those footage who were taken from a movie as a proof to target Hodeidah port, you can imagine they have launched and striked Yemen. More than 150,000 airstrike has been conducted on Yemen, according to some news outside news agency. And you can just imagine what kind of proof they had at that time to attack those areas. They have killed more than 18,000 Yemeni civilians, most of them children, because of those airstrikes. They have that blockade on Yemen, which have resulted in killing more than 300,000 Yemeni civilians.
The Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Al-Quds says extremist Israeli groups threaten the presence of Christians in the Holy City. In remarks published by the Times of London, Theophilus III says he believes that Israelis want to drive his community out of Al-Quds Old City, which is sacred to Muslims, Christians and Jews. He says the Christian community in the city is suffering greatly at the hands of Israeli extremists. The Patriarch underlined that Christians are the victims of hate crimes and their churches are regularly desecrated and vandalized. He added clergies are also frequently intimidated. Turning to other news now, a huge blaze in the U.S. state of New York leaves at least 19 people dead and dozens injured. The fire tears through a high-rise apartment building in the Bronx, a borough of New York City. Officials say several of the wounded are in critical condition. An overwhelming majority of the victims suffer from severe smoke inhalation. Firefighters discovered the victims on nearly every floor of the building. Many of them were experiencing cardiac and respiratory arrest. Firefighters rescued many residents by evacuating them through windows and climbing down ladders. The fire was reportedly caused by a portable electric heater. West African leaders decide to slap tough new sanctions, that is, on Mali in response to delays in holding promised elections after a 2020 military coup. The announcement followed an extraordinary summit of the leaders of the 15-member Economic Community of West African States in Ghana. The sanctions include border closures and a trade embargo. The leaders also agreed to cut financial aid and freeze Mali's assets at the Central Bank of West African States. Moreover, the bloc members will also recall their ambassadors from Mali. In August 2020, the military, led by Colonel Assimi Goïta, toppled then-elected President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta amid street protests against his unpopular rule. Russia says that initial talks with the U.S. on the eve of a forthcoming crucial meeting between Moscow and Washington has been, quote, complex but businesslike. Russian media say Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov has described a meeting with his U.S. counterpart Wendy Sherman as amazing. However, it is not clear if the veteran diplomat, whose rhetoric in recent weeks has been consistently hawkish, was speaking ironically. Russian and American diplomats are due to meet for talks in the Swiss capital city of Geneva on Monday. The meeting comes amid tensions between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine. Coronavirus measures have sparked protests across Western Europe amid a surge in cases mostly blamed on the Omicron variant. Around 5,000 Belgian protesters, a majority of them unmasked, have marched through the capital, Brussels. Some of them carried banners denouncing what they called a vaccine dictatorship. Police surrounded a small group that was approaching the EU headquarters. A protest against COVID restrictions is also held in the Netherlands. People hit the streets of the capital, Amsterdam, to express dissatisfaction with lockdown measures and mandatory proof of vaccination. Elsewhere in Europe, around 1,000 Danish protesters have rallied in the capital, Copenhagen. The protest was organized by an anti-vaccination radical group called Men in Black. An end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Biden's willingness to let the bankrupt and evil policy against Venezuela is a black mark on his record. This was a Trump-era policy that he inherited, so it would not have been that difficult for him to repudiate Trump's policy at the beginning of his term. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Daniel Larrison, writer. This article is published under the heading, The Cruel Farce of U.S. Regime Change Policy in Venezuela. Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration is continuing the farce that the U.S. government's regime change policy in Venezuela. Quote, the United States continues to recognize the authority of the democratically elected 2015 National Assembly as the last remaining democratic institution and Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. We welcome the agreement reached to extend the authority of the National Assembly elected in 2015 and of interim President Guaido as its president. Unquote. It was a mistake to recognize Guaido when he had some fig leaf of legitimacy 3 years ago, but to continue the charade now, several years later, when he and his allies have been less influenced and understanding than they did before, is truly absurd. The chief problem with recognizing him as interim president then was that he had no effective control over the state he was supposedly leading. There was initially a belief among regime changers that defectors from the military would lend their support to the cause, but this never amounted to more than a trickle, and the few that threw in their lot with Guaido were then left high and dry by the amateurish would-be coup attempt. Since then, the opposition has only lost ground. Fewer governments recognize Guaido today than recognized him in 2019, and his approval rating in Venezuela is abysmally low. As Francisco Rodriguez points out, the interim president has no real democratic or constitutional legitimacy. Guaido's claim is tenuous both legally and politically. He has never won a national election, his term as legislator expired more than a year ago, and his poll numbers are as low as other politicians. In addition to lacking legitimacy, he also lacks power inside the country. The military remains firmly on the side of Maduro and his allies. U.S. regime change policy has utterly failed to reach its goal, but it has still managed to inflict horrifying damage on the population. Rodriguez continues, the central idea of his maximum pressure approach, implemented by Trump and Biden, both through economic sanctions and by the transfer of control of Venezuelan government funds to Guaido's interim government, is that depriving the country of the funds needed to sustain its economy will bring about regime change. It hasn't, and it won't. It will simply contribute to worsening the country's humanitarian crisis, fuel animosity toward the United States regime, deepen opposition divisions, and weaken civil society. Rodriguez has authored a new study of the effects of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's economy, and his findings make alarming reading. He says, I argue that U.S. economic sanctions toward Venezuela, which in contrast to those of other nations, block the country's access to export and financial markets, have played a crucial role in limiting the country's access to foreign exchange, contributing to collapse of 72% of the country's per capita income, the equivalent of four Great Depressions and the largest contraction ever documented in Latin America. Aggregate data showed that oil production contracted after every U.S. decision to tighten sanctions, while detailed analysis of the evolution over time of output of oil-producing firms shows that companies with access to credit prior to sanctions suffer disproportionately from U.S. executive orders, barring access to capital markets. According to econometric estimates presented in the study, U.S. sanctions are responsible for at least half of the decline in Venezuela's oil production since 2017, depriving the country of the foreign currency revenue needed to import essential goods and sustain its economy. Rodriguez anticipates the objections of maximum pressure supporters and sets them aside, saying sanctions apologists have tried to muddy the discussion by arguing that it is Maduro and not sanctions that are to blame for Venezuela's plight. This argument is fallacious and disingenuous. No serious scholarly work have ever tried to deny that Maduro's policies contributed to the country's economic crisis. The United States regime should be seeking to design policies that do not increase suffering instead of just arguing that it is not causing as much damage as Maduro. It is bad enough to impose broad sanctions on a country when it has been enjoying relatively good economic conditions. Putting broad sanctions on Venezuela amounted to kicking the Venezuelan people down. Biden's willingness to let this bankrupt and evil policy against Venezuela continue, it's a black mark on Biden's record. This was a Trump-era policy that he inherited, so it would not have been that difficult for him to repudiate Trump's policy at the beginning of his term, whether because of inertia, political timidity, lack of imagination, or some combination of all three. Biden chose to keep the policy essentially unchanged. Cruel sanctions seems to be some of the only things that survive from one administration to the next. There is still time for Biden to change course, but judging from the administration's latest endorsement of Guaido, he has no intention of doing that. It falls to members of Congress, activists, and public to insist that the United States regime stop crushing the Venezuelan people with economic warfare.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadali and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio is our dear friends, Brother Ali Alawiyan and Brother Habib. I thank you both for joining us because we value your company a lot.
Thanks to you, brother. It's a great pleasure for us to be here.
Today, dear brothers, we will talk about lying. Just to start it off easily, just to ease into our discussion, I want to ask dear Brother Ali Alawiyan, what is the Islamic viewpoint on lying?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Basically, lying in Islam is known to be as a sin. So, no one in Islamic, let's say, environment, Islamic jurisprudence among the fuqaha and religious authorities considered it as, let's say, an ordinary act. So, lying by itself is a sin, and sometimes this lying becomes a greater sin, that is a kabira sin, that is
a greater sin,
when actually it enters the, let's say, the time that, for example, you attribute something to the Prophet and his household, which is not exactly is, or to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
So it becomes, this lying again even is more greater, and also it is considered as a great sin. So
because a lie, it actually produces another lie to keep up this lie going, and then you lie and lie and lie and lie.
It's not like that. It's not always like that, but right. It does result in it. Like I was, my brother was saying that lying has levels to it. Sometimes you lie, I lie, for example. I tell you, my brother Alawi did this. That was lying, for example. Right. So that's one lie. Another higher level of lying that is considered a major sin is lying by attributing false statements to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his Prophet.
So propaganda, false propaganda.
I'm not going to call it propaganda, false statements. These false statements, even if it was one letter, you know, in the Arabic language it's very precise, even one letter or changing one haraka or symbol in the Arabic grammar, and therefore you change the meaning. When you change the meaning, you're changing what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants for humanity to reach justice.
So Brother Habib, you say, and actually Islam says, because we're in agreement here, lying is not permissible.
That's true.
All forms of lying, Brother Habib, or do we have some permissible forms of lying?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Because when I entered the, you know, the chat with Brother Alwiyan, I didn't say it.
Yeah, they need to put it here.
So this topic has been highly debated in Al-Makasib Al-Muharramah, written by Sheikh Al-Ansari, and the scholars and the fuqaha, the jurists that come after him, give their ideas and thoughts on the topic based on what Sheikh Al-Ansari stated, whether they agree, they disagree, they put the detection, the evidence, the proof. Before him, Al-Allam Al-Majlisi has, in Bihar Al-Anwar, mentioned the topic of, in Mar'at Al-Uqud, Volume 10, he mentioned, because Al-Kafi has a chapter called Bab al-Kadhib, Al-Allam al-Majlisi explained the sayings available about lying, and at the end, he talks about one of the muhaqqiqin, and it might be Al-Imam al-Ghazali, from the Sunni scholars. He puts out his idea that lying is by itself, without any, secondary titles or secondary subjects, is considered a sin. But there might be secondary titles that change it from lying into not lying, or from lying into what? Into permissible lie.
Such as?
Not white lie, permissible lie.
Yeah, we do not say white lie. Yeah. Such as?
Such as, for example, fixing between your brothers.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you and Mr. Alawiyan got in a fight for some reason. For example, you guys were on the show.
God forbid.
You got in the fight for some reason.
Right.
So I go to Mr. Alawiyan. I tell him, you didn't tell me anything. All you did was smash and bash him. But I go to Mr. Alawiyan. I tell him, Habibi, Brother Musa was saying that you are one of the best guests that he ever hosted a show with.
Yeah.
Right? And then he just sticks at me all happy. I go to you. I tell you, Brother Musa, Brother Alawiyan said you are one of the best looking men in the world.
Right.
Yes. And you all looked at me very happy. And then you come, brothers, and forget all your problems, and you forget that you're even good-looking and that you're a good guest, for example. So
Sheikh Ali, this is the classic example, islah between the mu'mins.
Yes.
This is one case.
This is one case. Any other cases?
Yeah,
or?
There are two more cases for the permissible lying. I mean, but it doesn't mean that lying is something good that you are permitted.
You call it permissible lying. The sheikh just calls it not lying.
Because no, we have a saying that
became something else.
Yeah.
Tanzil al-kadhib manzilat adam al-kadhib. We have a saying where it says lying is not lying.
But you mean the same thing, just for the listeners. Yeah. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah. Actually, the word that is good for the, I mean, a good translation for that to presented to the listeners is something exactly what Sheikh said.
Right.
So another case is that you're in an urgency case. For example, a person who's keeping, let's say, a trust of another brother in faith, and another, let's say, a tyrant person comes to him to take it from him. He can say, okay, it's not with me anymore. Right. So just to keep the, let's say, the benefits of another Muslim brother.
Protect your fellow believer or his properties.
Yeah. There is another case that you are allowed, again, is inside the family. But does it mean that we have to lie to our wives or, let's say, to kids?
What does that mean?
Specifically, I want to mention in the cases of financial issues, when, for example, the wives are asking for, let's say, some expectation, and they have some expectation from the husband.
There's no money.
And there is no
money. Okay, yeah, just yeah.
Size on that.
Yeah.
There's no money.
And there is no money. You can't just promise them for some later time just to give them while you have not, you don't have it. We can promise them.
So that's a lie.
Yeah, that's a lie. That works for not lying. I don't know. Well, how did you define it?
Is a diplomatic solution.
Teoria? No. The same lie. What was the definition of this lying? You said what did you call it?
That permissible lie.
Is it good to say call it permissible lie?
Permissible lie.
Is it good? Permissible lying? Right. Yeah, not lying. Permissible lying.
So we are not looking at it as a lying in the way that, for example, all the relations between the family members become, be based on this lie, or a series of lies. No, just to actually save the
fix
family
the situation
from, and fix the situation and save the family from entering some, let's say, quarrels.
Argument, discussion, conflict. Yeah, so just to keep the family issues.
Quarrels, keep it and to lift it from the family, the pressure from the family. The husband can actually promise them with a lie in future, and later on he can say, okay, I was not able to manage it.
So right. This is one statement, just to clear it up more for the listeners. This is one statement from one of the great scholars. He states that lying has a definition, and that is to state something that is not the truth, that is not the reality. Hmm. Then you ask the second question. Is every statement that is not the reality or not saying the truth, is that considered prohibited? Every single example or application of not saying the truth, is that prohibited or not? It depends whether there was a maslaha or a good to it, or whether there was a bad to it. Mm. And usually there's a bad to it. Usually it's not good to do it. But sometimes when you say the truth, it will cause problems. Mm. Not even more than problems. It will cause killings and deaths and murders and explosions and whatever.
Right,
whatnot.
If you want to take it that far.
Yeah, because it does.
Can. It does.
It does, and it has happened.
But Brother Habib, what, aren't you just describing a white lie?
What is your definition of white lie, so I can understand you more? I'm very sorry for that. For making you a guest right now and making myself a host. But
No. For what I understand, a white lie is a lie that you say in order to not, for example, hurt the other person's feelings. Because there is a maslaha, as you said, there's a benefit.
Your wife
asks you, do you like the food I made you? It was horrible. You hate it. You never want to smell it or see it again. You say yes.
Yeah. Then therefore, that white lie that you call, that you define, then yes.
Right.
There's no problem with that. But you have to pay attention to all the aspects. For example, there might be something good for you in it. Because if I lie, for example, I'm going to get paid this much. I'm going to get this kind of money. At the same time, if I lie, even though it does bring good to me or bring good for others, when I lie, this person is going to lose his job. For example, I lie my CV, for example.
Yeah.
This person is going to lose his job. Mm. Right? And therefore, there's this, tadarub or conflict between that mafsada, that bad thing, and the maslaha that you want and you crave, the good thing. So therefore, it remains as a prohibited action.
So, you are actually saying if you want to do this sort of permissible lying, this white lie, it must be to the benefit not just to you or to you, but also to all the Muslims. Or
society
those
together. Society. Society together, your community.
Believers, just believers. To summarize it. To the believers. Yeah. Okay, I am a Muslim. I live in...
Of course, we're talking... I'm very sorry. I have to add this because it's important. Yeah? We're talking about, haram. We're talking about law right now.
Right, yeah.
We're not talking about
you're
morals.
Because
al-kidhib yujurru al-kidhib. Do not joke. Do not lie while joking.
Even
do not joke with lies.
That's not permissible.
Because small lies drag bigger lies.
Very true.
So there's this also moral aspect of not lying.
Even jokes which are in lie, or the kind of, let's say, lie that you say in the form of joke, even that is actually not permissible.
Yeah, it is prohibited. There's even the topic of
a Siddiqoon, right? What is a Siddiqoon? The person that tells the truth very much, and that's very truthful.
Mm.
So how can you be a truthful person when you joke with lying?
Right.
There goes stand-up comedy in Islam.
Well, that's a whole another topic. But just to take it back to the perspective of law before we enter the ethical debate and moral debate. I am a Muslim. I'm a believer. Or to make it more clear, I'm a Shia Muslim. And either I lived 500 years back under a certain Islamic country which persecuted Muslims, or I live in present-day areas where Wahhabism or anti-Shia sentiment is present, and it is directly threatening to my life if I, for example, pray on a turba, or if I say I'm a Shia Muslim. May I lie here, Brother Ali Alouyan?
There is a greater expediency here, which is called taqiyya, or dissemination. This is a greater expediency for the sake of the survival of the lives and souls of Muslims, and this is something that even we have a Quranic witness for that as well. Allah أن تتقوا منهم تقات. So we have even in Quran that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers to that, and ask the companions of the Prophet, you can just deny your even Islam just to tell them that you are not following Muhammad on that easy, because so this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala permits us to say, to save the life
of a Muslim. Brother Habib said, how can it be a Siddiq if you also lie?
That's taqiyya. See, there's a difference between
So this is another form of lying, but it's permissible.
Taqiyya, like how my brother stated, it's, you know, you have that fear, and if you show off, it's not, it doesn't only go back to lying, to saying that no, I'm not Muslim or I'm not Shia, right? It goes back to the fact of having fear and not doing some actions and having to lie in some situations. So yeah, it's more general. But what I want to say is that there's this topic of muwarat, where you, it's not lying. For example, I tell you, I don't have no money in my hands.
What is muwarat in English, please?
I don't know the exact translation of it. That's why I didn't translate it. But I'm going to give an example. It will become very clear. For example, I'm a poor person. I'm not going to say you're a poor person, because this is the first time me doing a show. It's the third time
you shouldn't say
a
poor person. Say Fanan person is a poor person, for example.
No. I want to do it with me, because that's how I bring up examples. Sorry, that's my way.
So okay, you're
example,
the poor person.
I come
person.
And ask you, right? And what do you say? You have money in your pockets. You have
Are
money
you asking
in your pockets.
Me for money?
Yeah.
You're a beggar.
Yeah. I have money. You have money in your pockets. But what do? You say, look, I have no money in my hands.
And with that, we'll unfortunately have today's program, because we are out of time. I thank you for your inputs, brothers. It has been very fruitful to be a part of this discussion. I hope it was also beneficial to the listeners.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside, I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. As I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Lord Barwell, the former UK Prime Minister Theresa May's Chief of Staff, who held the office of Housing Minister in the year before the Grenfell Tower disaster on 14th of June 2017, is likely to face questioning over how he handled direct fire safety warnings from the London Fire Commissioner, Danny Cotton. We now present you an article written by Robert Booth. The piece is titled Grenfell Inquiry, Ex-Ministers and Serving Secretary of State to be Cross-Examined. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Four former UK ministers and a serving Secretary of State will be cross-examined this year in a potentially politically explosive climax to the four-year Grenfell Tower public inquiry. Eric Pickles, the former Secretary of State for Communities, Brandon Lewis, the current Northern Ireland Secretary, and the former Housing Minister Gavin Barwell will face hours of questioning over claims Conservative-led governments prioritised a bonfire of red tape over safety. Senior politicians are likely to be interviewed on how they responded to direct warnings about safety in high-rise blocks from the Commissioner of the London Fire Brigade just weeks before the Grenfell disaster. James Wharton, a former junior minister and close ally of Boris Johnson, and Stephen Williams, a former Liberal Democrat junior minister, are also expected to give evidence in person. Over 3 months, the inquiry will turn the spotlight from the actions of combustible materials manufacturers and the consultants and builders involved in the council block's disastrous refurbishment to the government that pursued, lawyers for the bereaved claim, a political ideology which broke free from common sense and safety constraints. Michael Gove, the Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, has already admitted the government failed people at Grenfell and told MPs that, on a couple of occasions, it had not necessarily appreciated the importance of fire safety and not necessarily done everything in the wake of the Laconnell House tragedy, a 2009 tower block fire where 6 people died, that it should have done. While the inquiry will look at the actions of governments going back to the 1990s, a principal context will be what David Cameron described in 2012 as his government's resolution to kill off the health and safety culture for good. The bereaved have called for David Cameron to give evidence to explain his policy, but the inquiry has not asked him to do so, and Lord Pickles will field important questions. Lord Pickles was David Cameron's cabinet minister in charge of building safety from 2010 to 2015 and will be asked why the government failed to overhaul fire regulation guidance, despite an instruction to do so by the coroner under Lacconnell House fire. The inquiry has heard the ambiguity of the guidance, which remained in place at the time of the Grenfell disaster on 14th of June 2017, was a significant factor in allowing companies and consultants to use combustible materials. In one letter disclosed to the inquiry, Lord Pickles is shown assuring the coroner there would be a future review, but arguing fire protection in buildings is a complex subject and should remain to some extent in the realm of professionals. Lawyers for the bereaved have argued the government became the junior partner in a relationship with the house building industry, which allowed companies too much control over standards. In 2011, Pickles launched the Red Tape Challenge to slash bureaucracy facing business. In the budget that year, a new rule was introduced that required a waiver for any change to the building regulations. The inquiry will examine internal Whitehall documents showing how in 2015, a civil service briefing for the then Housing Minister, Lord Wharton, was explicit that the review had been postponed, while the department focused its attention on other priorities, including the Red Tape Challenge. Anne Studd QC, counsel for the Mayor of London, has argued only lip service was paid to the commitment to the coroner to review the regulations. Pickles has so far told the inquiry in a statement he does not recall the potential industry use of combustible materials in external cladding systems was ever raised with me. Pickles is also likely to be questioned on his resistance to introducing sprinklers as a safety measure, which the Fire Brigade Union has told the inquiry would have saved lives at the Grenfell Tower. In October of 2013, when the Welsh Government made sprinklers mandatory for new-build homes, Pickles complained it had hit the housing market with extra red tape, adding £13,000 to the cost of building a new home. In fact, a government briefing note disclosed to the inquiry said that the amount was no more than £3,000. The inquiry may ask where he got his numbers from. In February 2014, Lewis, a junior minister under Pickles at the time, told Parliament that sprinklers work but referred to a one-in-two-out rule as part of the coalition's red tape policy and said, in that context, we want to exhaust all non-regulatory options before we introduce any new regulations. Ministers were also likely to be asked about their dealings with Sir David Amess, the Tory backbencher who was killed in October. In 2014, Sir David Amess chaired the All-Party Parliamentary Fire Safety and Rescue Group, which was pressing Williams, the Housing Minister at the time, to get on with the building regulations review ordered after Lacconnell House disaster. Penny Mordaunt, an undersecretary in the department at the time, told Sir David Amess that Williams had seen no evidence it was urgent and that he was not willing to disrupt the work of the department by getting on with it. The inquiry has heard this was chilling. Sir David Amess's group replied that it was at a loss to understand how independent evidence, which had life safety implications, was not urgent. It said, should a major fire tragedy with loss of life occur between now and 2017, where the matters which had been raised here were found to be contributory to the outcome, then the group would be bound to bring this to others' attention. Lord Barwell, Theresa May's former chief of staff, who held the office of Housing Minister in the year before the Grenfell disaster, is likely to face questioning over how he handled direct fire safety warnings from the London Fire Commissioner Danny Cotton. On 3rd of April 2017, Danny Cotton told Lord Barwell and Lewis, by that time policing and fire minister, of mounting evidence of issues of concern within residential buildings and in particular blocks of flats, about compartmentation and the impact on the policy of telling people to stay put in the event of a blaze. She said, "We are also concerned about contractor competency and how this influences compartmentation deficiencies and therefore occupant safety." The inquiry has already found this was prescient, as the compartmentation failed catastrophically at the Grenfell Tower, partly because of poor workmanship, and a stay-put policy was kept in place for too long, costing lives. A significant civil servant facing questioning will be Brian Martin, a former building control officer who rose to be senior advisor to ministers on building regulations. He is likely to be asked what he knew about companies bringing dangerous, non-compliant materials to the market by exploiting confusion in how the building regulations should be met. Michael Mansfield QC, representing some of the bereaved families, has alleged that Michael Martin took an attitude that was complacent and collusive with a dangerous, out-of-control industry. In July of 2014, Martin emailed a contact at the National House Building Council, which provided building control and warranty services for new-built homes, saying that reliable sources had been telling him that combustible foam insulation was being used in cladding on high-rise flats. He referred to polyisocranulate foam, the kind specified for Grenfell Tower that fueled the fire and released toxic gas, but all he said was, "The purpose of my email is a friendly warning. You might want to double-check with your inspectors that they are on top of this." The inquiry resumes on 24th of January. Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means.